Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the very first inaugural. Well, I can't say very first and inaugural. They mean the same thing. Look, there we go. We're 10 seconds into it.
That's going to be on the bloopers.
You know, that's actually, I'll leave it in there just so people know from the outset that I'm an idiot. The very first episode of the Life of Caesar podcast series. My name is Cameron Riley. As you can probably tell from the accent, I'm an Aussie. Deal with it. And my co-host, who I'm very excited to be doing this show with, all the way from Virginia, is Raymond Q. Harris, the world's leading expert on all things Julius Caesar, as well as you probably may remember him from such things as the World War II podcast. Ray, welcome to our new show.
Thank you very much. Just a couple of corrections. It's just Virginia. Don't beat it about too much. And it's just Ray Harris, and that will be fine. Not Mr. Harris or professor or anything like that.
Right.
I'm very humble. I've been humbled many times. I am very excited to be here. I've read about Caesar and Rome and all this stuff for years, and so I'm just very excited to be able to talk about him once again, and this time have other people hear it.
So we should qualify my previous statement. Neither of us are experts on Caesar.
Absolutely.
Just like neither of us are experts on World War II or Napoleon. Some people may have listened to the Napoleon podcast that I did with J. David Markham recently. But you and I are passionate about Caesar.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of people, we're standing on the shoulders of people who have done a lot of hard work. I've read a lot of books, World War II. You've read a lot of books about Napoleon. And now together we're going to read a lot of books about Caesar, and we're just going to share with everyone. And hopefully the enthusiasm will come across and we'll just have a good time with it. And hopefully everybody will learn something on each episode.
And hopefully they'll learn something, and they'll also understand a little bit why we're excited about Caesar. I mean, it's funny. I've been over the last month or so, I've got 13-year-old twin boys, and I've been reading Shakespeare's Julius Caesar with them. I do a thing on a Saturday with them called Culture Hour, which they hate, but I make them listen to classical music or read Shakespeare. Or last week, and we actually did The Raven by Poe. But I've been getting really excited about the story and explaining to them, and they're looking at me like, dude, what is your problem? and I think of our audiences, my 13-year-old sons, and you and I are going to try and convince them why understanding a bit more about Caesar is an important thing, because it really is. And there's so much about where we are today, what the world is like today, that you can take back to a variety of people in history, I think. But Julius Caesar definitely stands as one of the great characters in all of human history.
Absolutely. If Caesar had been different, or if he hadn't been born, I think it's fair to say the Western world would have been different. So he's definitely in the top three or the top five list of people who have affected life as we know it. So he definitely deserves his own podcast.
I agree. So what we thought we'd do with this first episode, ladies and gentlemen, is just give you a basic introduction to the character of Julius Caesar. Before we get into telling a linear story, which we'll do in episode two, we'll go back and we'll explain what was happening pre-Caesar in Rome, and we'll talk about, you know, Caesar's career, and we'll then do a linear series, and we don't know how long it'll go for, maybe years. I asked the question, how many episodes have you done in your World War II podcast so far?
So far, I have put out technically 94. So I'm almost to that 100th mark, so I can hopefully celebrate that soon. But yeah, it's been almost, it's been 3.5 years, 94 episodes. So, we'll see how far Caesar takes us.
And I think Markham and I did about 60 on Napoleon over about 3 years. So yeah, you and I are kicking off a 3-year journey. Let's say that with some assurance.
There we go.
I was thinking in preparation for this, you know, what does the average person know about Caesar? Are there any myths or any misconceptions or just any general ideas that people have about Julius Caesar that we can explore or correct? When most people think of Julius Caesar, what do you think comes to mind, Ray?
Right. Well, I certainly think that he was a great military leader or a general, you know, a military genius, if you will. For people my age, he probably looked a lot like Rex Harrison or Charlton Heston. For the younger people, I'm sure he looks like a more younger actor. But basically, yeah, just the fact that he was probably the king of Rome and that he was a great military leader and he stabbed. And as he's dying, someone said, and he says, E2 Brute. So other than that, you're never really sure what people know or think they know.
Yeah, I think that some people may think that he was actually an emperor or the first emperor of Rome. For some reason, I think, you know, we know that Caesars are emperors, and we think, well, Julius Caesar was a Caesar, he was the first Caesar. Well, he wasn't actually the first Caesar, but he's the first Caesar that most people are aware of. But of course, he wasn't an emperor, was he? Why don't we talk about what he actually was when he died?
Yeah, before the as far as what I've been able to gather, before the last. Well, let me try that again. I'm sorry. Before the latest, before the next civil war comes along, he is made a dictator. There are certain people of another part of the Senate who are trying to keep him out. He crosses the Rubicon. He breaks the rules. He comes into Rome, and he's made dictator. I'm not sure. Was that good? I don't think I really like that at all. I'm sorry. I'm trying to say like 15 things at once. Tell you what, just stop and just ask your question again, and then I'll give my answer. I'm sorry.
That's cool, man.
I'm so sorry.
Well, why don't you just kick it off? So people think he was an emperor, but he wasn't an emperor, was he?
Right. At the time, he was the dictator, which was an office that was held by one person to clean up whatever mess was going on at the time. And when all the problems were settled, they were supposed to lay down their dictatorship, and the two consuls would come back. So he was certainly not the king. It was offered to him several times, and he always pushed it away. He said no. He just wanted to get Rome back up on its feet again. But of course, the people who were fighting against him weren't going to accept that version of the truth, and so he was never king of Rome.
Yeah, but he was even a little bit more than a dictator. I mean, it was interesting back in ancient Rome. This idea of dictator was deliberately built into their political system. As you say, there had been periods of political instability in the preceding century, in particular in Rome, and there was this idea that, okay, if things got too out of hand and we needed a firm hand to guide us through a troublesome time, we could appoint somebody as dictator, and you know, people had fulfilled that role previously for short periods of time. But shortly before Caesar's assassination, the Senate named him censor for life and father of the fatherland. So, I mean, there were some good reasons for naming a dictator or giving them a lifelong power in a similar way. Sorry to be harking back to Napoleon at this early stage in the show, but the same one of the reasons why Napoleon became emperor of France was because there were assassination attempts by the royalists, and he kind of figured, well, at least part of his justification was, well, if I'm emperor rather than just first consul and they assassinate me, then the power is just going to go to my family. He didn't have any children at the time, but to a brother or something like that. So the idea was that it would remove some of the incentive for political assassination.
Right. And one of the most – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you, after you.
I'm sorry. One of the most important aspects of the dictatorship was that whatever decisions they made had to be accepted. You couldn't go back and try to change them after the person laid down their dictatorship. It had to be accepted. And that was just their, like you said, it was built in. That was their way of saying things gotten so bad, we can't run things by committee. Let's put one person in charge. They'll clean it up. Excuse me. They'll clean it up. They'll lay down their dictatorship and we can get on with the way things are supposed to be. So it was a very good system. It had worked many times. Sulla was able to use it to put the country back together. Then he laid it down.
Yeah.
But there were just forces that were against Caesar who weren't going to accept anything that he did, because I think by that time it had gotten personal and it was just going to go to the death of somebody.
And I think you bring up a really interesting point talking about Sulla. I think certainly before I started reading more about Caesar years ago, I had the impression that Caesar was responsible for the fall of the Roman Republic. And whilst he was sort of, I guess, the crux of it, it sort of came to a head under Julius Caesar's dictatorship. Obviously, this had been brewing for a long time. You know, he wasn't responsible. Or was he responsible? Do you think he was responsible for the collapse of the Republic?
Well, Sulla gets the onus of being one of the first to march on Rome, and he certainly terrorized them. And in a lot of ways, his dictatorship was given to him through intimidation, a lot like Caesar's was.
Why don't we explain for the listeners who Sulla was?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sulla was one of the people who came before Caesar, and he worked very closely with Gaius Marius, one of the innovating great generals of the Roman Republic, who was able to defeat the Germans as they were making a threat to Rome. But Sulla was certainly not someone who worried too much about rules, and once his dignitas or auctoritas was challenged, he was going to do whatever he needed to do.
And he actually,
just to give you an idea. No, I'm sorry.
Uh-huh. Oh, I was just going to say, he actually marched on Rome with his army twice.
Twice. Well, the first time he was given an assignment, and Gaius Marius wanted it. So Gaius Marius got the Senate to change it and to give him the war against Mithridates, which I'm sure we'll get into to some degree. And Sulla was like, oh, I don't think so. So he turned around and came back on Rome. But neither Sulla nor Caesar can singularly be blamed for the fall of the Republic. It's a very complex issue. It comes down to a lot of different factors and a lot of different people. And you really can't just point the finger at one person and say they ruined everything that had been going on in the Roman Republic for the last, 400 years.
I like the way you said, Sulla said, I don't think so. Like, he was the original black girl. He was like, mm-hmm, honey.
Well,
I should have my wife up here to do that. She does a much better black girl than me.
On his gravestone, Sulla's thing said, no better friend, no worse enemy. And that's how he lived his life.
Nice. That's not a bad epitaph to have on your gravestone,
is it?
I remember the line that, I don't remember. I have it written down, but it's one of my favorite lines. From Plutarch, when he's talking about Sulla, he says, Sulla now began to make blood flow, and he filled the city with deaths without number or limit. So, you know, he was a brutal guy. He got shit done.
Yeah. Well, he figured out how to not only raise money for all the debt that Rome was in, but also to get rid of his enemies by having the list of proscriptions, which Caesar ended up on that list. We can go into that an hour later. But Sulla was all about, you know, getting rid of his enemies literally and making money out of it for the betterment of Rome, because that's what he was focused on.
And
he was a very conservative person, yeah, and he was going to bring back Rome and put it back on its proper form, in his opinion.
And Caesar, as you say, ended up on that list. He was very young at the time, but he was the son-in-law of Cinna, who was one of Sulla's enemies. And Caesar actually had to get the hell out of Dodge to save his life at that time.
Yeah, Sulla said, you are married to someone who sided with Gaius Marius, who Sulla and Gaius Marius end up going their separate ways and hating each other very much. So, but anyway, Sulla says to Caesar, divorce this person that Gaius Marius made you marry. And Caesar sees his way out of this role that he was in, which forbade him to be in the military or into politics. So he said no to Sulla. And as you can imagine, very few people said no to Sulla. So he had to get out of town, and his name was added to the list. And just literally, you know, thousands of people died. They had their property taken. It was sold at very cheap prices. A lot of people made a lot of money, but Sulla didn't care. He was raising money to put Rome back on her feet.
And the historian Suetonius, when writing about this whole period, said that Sulla claims anyway that Sulla said in this Caesar there are many Mariuses, and how right he was,
right,
in a way. So anyway, but as we said before, Sulla did resign the dictatorship, but you know, the question I guess that were in the minds particularly of the Senate was whether or not Caesar would resign the dictatorship, or if he wanted to be king. He was already dictator for life.
Right.
And I guess we really don't know what was in the mind of Caesar. It's, you know, impossible for us to tell.
Right. At the end of the day, the sad truth is the vast majority of any contemporary writing has been lost. There was some writing done after Caesar died and after Augustus dies, and so there's things written about Caesar way after he's dead. So we'll never know what his true belief, as far as religion goes, his belief in a deity, and did he really want to be king? You know, we'll never know the answer to that, which is another thing that makes him fascinating. We know he did amazing things. He changed the world. He certainly changed Central Europe, but we'll never know what was in his head. And so were those people who were lined up against him in the Senate paranoid? Were they just using that as an excuse, or were they right in trying to stop someone who was trying to make himself the king of Rome?
Mm. I mean, of course, you know, that all backfired on them anyway. They ended up,
with
a whole series of Caesars that came out.
Right.
I mean, if they hadn't assassinated Julius, maybe, you know, we would never have had Augustus as emperor anyway.
Yeah, and two of the people that that killed Caesar in the Senate were pardoned by him. So again, his story is just an amazing, tragic story. He tried to be as lenient as he could, and he paid the price for that in the end.
So let me ask you a personal question. I mean, what is it about Caesar that keeps you interested?
Yeah, just someone who was born in a certain time, in a certain country, in a certain culture, in a certain class, and he just thought he was a superior person to most people, and he probably was. I mean, he was a writer, a politician, a statesman, a general, a lawyer. He was just a well-rounded, gifted person, which can be very annoying to people. But when you have someone who's born with all these abilities and he's born into the upper crust of society, he's just going to go far, and everything he does is going to be amazing. Where if there's just someone who's born on the lower end of the socioeconomic level, they're not going to be able to make an impact and change history. And there's just something about Caesar that that draws me to him. Probably the best compliment I've ever heard about a leader applies to Caesar, who was a very practical man. He could be in his general's tent, sitting in his curule chair. He could have the red flag outside his tent saying that the general is in. Someone could walk into the tent and give him the best news he could possibly hear for himself or for Rome. And then 5 minutes later, someone could run into the tent telling him the worst news he could possibly hear for himself and for Rome. And Caesar, from everything I've been able to read, would have responded to both men in the same way. He would sit there and go, okay, how can I best use this information for myself and for Rome? And for someone who was just that practical, who was that methodical, who could be that cold and calculating, they're going to do a lot of amazing things. They're going to get a lot of things done. And he did. And I just, for some reason, find that very fascinating.
Mm. But it wasn't a smooth journey for him. I mean, we've already talked about the trouble he got into as a young man with Sulla. His entire career, I mean, his relationship with Pompey is fascinating. But the rise of his career was in many ways a result of his ability to borrow money from people. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a lot of wealth, even though the Caesars as a family and the Julies as a family, more importantly, had a long tradition in Rome going back to, they were part of the patrician class, supposedly going mm-hmm. back to the original founders of Rome several centuries before. But he wasn't one of the wealthiest didn't come from one of the wealthiest families in Rome, and it was almost expensive to be a politician in Rome, in ancient Rome, as it is to run for president in the United States today. It took a serious amount of wealth, and consequently, Caesar had to borrow a lot of money over the years, didn't he?
Yeah, and that's another part of the answer to your question, why do I find him fascinating? I mean, basically, he rubbed elbows with all the people that mattered near the end of the Roman Republic. He was a nephew of Gaius Marius. He was related by marriage to Sulla. He was friends and partners with Pompey the Great, as well as Marcus Crassus, probably the richest man in Rome. And his contemporaries and the people he interacted with were these in themselves amazing people. Cicero. But yeah, he had to borrow Cicero. Exactly. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have left Cicero out. Sorry. but yeah, he had to borrow a lot of money from Crassus and to put on games to get his name out there specifically and to win the people over so he could run for office. And he was in debt a lot. And he, in fact, he doesn't end up getting out of debt until one, he goes to Spain and makes a fortune. And then when he goes to Gaul, by the time he gets back from Gaul, he's got more money than he could ever spend or count. And so it's amazing that he partnered with Pompey and he partnered with Crassus and he got them to, who hated each other, to come together and be a partner with him. And in the end, he ends up out-generaling Pompey and having more money than Crassus. But he just had to get a start and he had to borrow money just like everybody else did.
Yeah, and he was kind of betting on the fact that he would get his chance to go and lead an army in a distant land and, as you say, make big bank. But that's also part of what got him into trouble towards the end. The more powerful he became, the more suspicious his colleagues and competitors, you might say, became of him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of interesting things that about the story of Caesar that I think we need to touch on in this first episode. And one of those is this idea of crossing the Rubicon.
Right.
Now, I don't know if people have heard much. I've heard that term before. I asked my wife this morning if she was familiar with it. She wasn't. But, you know, you will often hear people say, oh, so-and-so crossed their personal Rubicon. And because most of us these days don't have much of a classical education, that idiom may not mean much to a lot of people. But to help people, if they're wondering, the idiom crossing the Rubicon these days tends to mean passing the point of no return. Now, it comes from the river, the Rubicon. It's a river in northeastern Italy. It's about 80 kilometers long. And there was this tradition in the Roman Republic that the Rubicon marked the boundary between the Roman province of Cisalpine Gaul and Rome itself, in Italy proper. So there was this tradition that when a Roman general, who was typically an elected magistrate, had gone away and they had an army, they were coming back, they had to leave the army behind at the Rubicon and enter back as a citizen again. And of course, you know, this was part of the concern that they had about, you know, generals with armies coming into Rome to take power by force. They had to disband their armies. And there was a basic law that you would be condemned to death. Both the general and his soldiers would be immediately declared outlaws and condemned to death if they entered Italy proper with their army. But of course, Julius Caesar decided in about 49 BCE that he would lead a single legion over the Rubicon into Italy and make his way to Rome. And in doing so, deliberately broke the law and became an outlaw. And fortunately for Caesar, he managed to survive and pull it off, and his enemies, Pompey being one of them, went on the run. But Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, why, Ray? Why do you think Caesar decided to break the law and centuries of tradition by crossing the Rubicon with an army in 49?
Right. Yeah. The backstory, like you were saying, is the Roman Republic was set up with 400 years of tradition. It was set up in a very complex way on purpose, so no one man could outshine the others. And with Caesar, with his talent, and his ability, and in some instances luck, was just shining more brightly than a lot of them. A lot of them became jealous. There was a group of them called the Optimates. The side that Caesar was on was called the Populares, and they were just going to get to the point where they were going to get rid of him. They tried several times. They almost succeeded. He was able to wriggle out of it, and so basically, it's getting to the point where he was going to run for consul again. And so when he's in office, he has his imperium. He cannot be charged with any crimes as long as he's in office. So he was going to run for consul again. They weren't going to allow him to do it. He wanted to run in absentia, you know, not having to show up in Rome. And the Optimates got Pompey to say, hey, look, war's coming. We want you to be our leader, which Pompey was more than happy to do. And so Caesar is basically backed into a corner. He could either back down, give up his dignitas, his auctoritas, and accept probably being banished or maybe even killed, and certainly not be able to run for office, which means he'll be open to prosecution. And he just there was no way he was going to let that happen. So he crosses the Rubicon. He thought about it a lot. He purposefully overpaid his soldiers a lot so they would be loyal to him and not to the idea of Rome. And he made them basically fall in love with him, and they'd be willing to do anything. And so he crosses the Rubicon. And according to Plutarch, he said, let the dice be thrown. But according to Suetonius, he said, the die is cast as he crosses over. So it was some kind of gambling metaphor, as in he knew he might win, he might lose, but it was better than willingly lay down and take whatever the Optimates were going to do, because Caesar had never willingly gave up before. And so he was certainly going to take his chance. And based on his past experience, he was right to do that.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people to understand. I mean, you can look at this a number of ways. I mean, you can look at it as, well, Caesar was just ambitious, and mm-hmm. he, you know, was determined to overthrow the Republic and appoint himself as king or emperor or even just as dictator. But right. then you've got to think about it from Caesar's perspective. I mean, there was a tradition in Rome that when one of the magistrates, a consul or somebody like that, had gone away and been given a governorship of a region such as Gaul, they would, mm-hmm. you know, they could be accused of crimes against Rome, stealing money, et cetera, that belonged in the coffers right. of Rome, because they, you know, quite often made themselves wealthy, either legitimately or illegitimately, while they're away. And, you know, once they came back to Rome, after their governorship had expired, their term, which is what had happened in Caesar's case, mm-hmm. charges could be doctored, could be made up, if, you know, or they could be, you know, genuine charges. But either way, it was kind of a dangerous time for a retired governor when you came back to Rome. You could find yourself
right.
being charged with a crime, imprisoned, and possibly even excommunicated or banished to a distant land. So, right. you know, from Caesar's perspective, he's probably thinking, well, you know, I'm not sure that this is a good thing. Not sure that...
it's not good for him.
Yeah, I mean, we the legal system in Rome at the time was obviously highly influenced by politics.
Right, and the Optimates had already broken so many rules and laws of their own to get Caesar in that corner. Basically, they made Pompey a consul without a colleague. That was totally unconstitutional. And there, you know, if Caesar's like, if y'all are going to break the laws, I'm going to break the laws too, and let the best man win. So he wasn't the only one who was ignoring the rules that he didn't like.
Exactly. But, you know, again, I think that a lot of people just who haven't studied this period or studied Caesar may think that, well, Caesar was a bad guy. It's, again, I hate to reflect on Napoleon, but it's the same thing that we always say about Napoleon. Mm-hmm. I mean, people have a view of Napoleon as being an ambitious warmonger. What they don't realize is that the United Monarchs of Europe were attacking France well before Napoleon's time, you know, going back to the Revolution, and he was forced into a situation where he had to defend France against these oppressive monarchs. And in his own way, Caesar's die was cast not by himself necessarily, but by the rest of the Senate. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, listening to your Napoleon podcast, there's so much more to Napoleon, just like Caesar, than being a general. There were so many domestic reforms that Napoleon did, and there were so many things that Caesar had already done, and he wanted this solved so he could get back to Rome to change things and to put Rome back on the right proper footing, according to him, because Rome was really messed up in almost every way, as far as society, as far as their politics and the government and the way they were treating many of their provinces. And he just wanted to fix things. This was nothing more than just a piece of the overall puzzle for Caesar. This wasn't the beginning of the end of everything. He was just trying to carry on, get back to Rome, and fix things that he saw as broken, because he had been gone, you know, for many years up to this point.
Yeah, and as we indicated earlier on, there had been at least a century of decline of the Roman Republic.
Mm-hmm.
Civil wars and mass murder and political instability and, you know, obviously a huge wealth disparity. And,
right.
You know, Caesar wasn't the first to try and institute massive political reform. There'd been, you know, a variety, the Gracchi, etc., a variety of magistrates, consuls, and families, wealthy families that had tried to institute reform before Caesar. But, you know, he was trying to institute massive constitutional reforms, and that was always seen with a lot of cynicism by the wealthy elite, the patrician class of Rome. It was almost like, you know, a contemporary equivalent would be like somebody running for president or prime in the United States or prime minister in Australia and offering mm-hmm. to give everybody, a bump of $10,000. If I get elected, everyone right. gets $10,000, or everyone gets right. some free land or something like that. This really popularist approach to winning votes. There was some skepticism as to, well, is this really about constitutional reform, or is this about Caesar just trying to appeal to the populace and get himself more power? Was it a power play?
Right. And people have to remember that he was born, I mean, he lived in his mother's insula. She owned a large complex and she rented rooms to people. So when Caesar was growing up, he saw many different walks of life. He saw many different nationalities, many different cultures were right there in his living quarters. And so he wasn't like a lot of the optimates, who basically was a very small group of Romans, most of them senators and all rich and all that kind of stuff. And so he had a different view of life, and he was just going to set Rome back up on the way he thought it should be. And they wanted to keep the status quo, or at least whatever they thought was a proper way. And so it was a clash of wills. It was a clash of culture and Rome's future. And again, everything that he did affected Rome, which affected the Roman world, which affected, you know, the Western Europe. And so, again, that's just one of the reasons why Gaius Julius Caesar is someone who should be studied. He did a lot of amazing things.
Mm. And, of course, you know, we'll never really know what was in his mind. But by, you know, examining his acts and reading his words, we can try and get a sense of what his genuine agenda may have been, and obviously we'll explore that as the podcast series goes on.
Right, and also what influence, if any, did Cleopatra have? Because she was certainly wanting to take the resources of Egypt and mix it with the ability of Caesar and his fighting men and expand the empire. So that will come into play much later. But again, we'll never really know because he either didn't write it down or it didn't survive. And so we'll just have to go off what he did, just like you said.
Well, Cleopatra, that's I'm glad that you introduced the subject of Cleopatra. That's, I guess a lot of people, when they think of Caesar, may think of Cleopatra, but they may not understand really her role in Caesar's life and downfall. They probably know of Cleopatra as the last pharaoh of ancient Egypt. But, I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about her? I mean, obviously people that know anything about her know that she was really of Greek heritage, going back to Alexander the Great, the Ptolemaic Egyptian rule that stemmed from Alexander the Great's death and empire, etc. Obviously another great figure in ancient history.
Yeah, she was a lot like Caesar. She was very practical. She was fighting for the Egyptian throne with her brother. excuse me. She was fighting for the throne. And Caesar, who had defeated Pompey in a civil battle, a civil war at Pharsalus, chased him to Egypt. And so he goes there to catch Pompey to bring him back. And from what I was able to read, he was going to pardon him, just like he'd pardoned so many others, but obviously keep an eye on him. So he goes to Egypt and he finds that the Egyptians, thinking they were going to please Caesar, the new master of Rome, killed him and cut his head off and gave it to Caesar in a jar or something like that. So now Caesar's involved in the Egyptian politics and he's got to decide what to do. And Cleopatra was able to very well presents her argument to Caesar. They have an affair. He spends a lot of time there, probably more than he should have before he headed back to Rome. So as huge as his life is, as amazing as it is, it suddenly gets wrapped up in another amazing person in Egypt, and suddenly their worlds all come together. And it's just an amazing story that I can't wait to get to.
Yeah. And I just want to point out that when they had their affair, Cleopatra was 21 and Caesar was 52.
Yes. Sorry. That gives people like my age hope for the future. I'm very excited about that.
How does your wife feel about that?
She doesn't need to know.
I've lost my train of thought now. Okay.
Sorry. She's never listened to my World War II podcast. She'll never listen to this. I'm reasonably safe.
Yeah. I met my wife at the Napoleonic Conference as a result of my Napoleon podcast, and she still never listened to it. You know,
wow.
Yeah, there you go. That's wives.
You must really love her.
Uh-huh. I do. We'll talk. As you said, we'll talk more about Cleopatra, but that is a really interesting part of the Caesar story. What else do you want to talk about? Do you want to bring up a Caesar anecdote that we should cover in this part?
There's another thing. If you know nothing about Caesar, then you might not know this. But if you know a little bit about Caesar, you've probably heard about this, but you're not sure. He was accused of either being a homosexual or a bisexual, or maybe just a very practical man who was willing to do anything to get things done. But somewhere around 89 BCE, he was sent by his commander to Bithynia. And this is in northern Turkey. And so he goes to Bithynia, and he does such a good job of raising a fleet from this king who was known to be gay that a lot of people assumed that he had sacrificed his virtue to get the fleet, and he was actually accused of being a homosexual, or he was also called the Queen of Bithynia, and so that stuck with him for the rest of his life. No matter how many wives he had, and he had several. No matter how many affairs he had, and he had numerous affairs. But those were all for political reasons, which was very entertaining. I can't wait to get into those. That accusation never quite left him. So, again, we'll never really know. It's like a lot of other things, but that's just one of the things that makes him interesting and mysterious. Was he gay? Was he bi? Was he so willing to do whatever it took to succeed? Was he willing to do that as well? So it's just one of those things that might come up or people might have questions about.
Mm. Yeah, that rumor of him having an affair with Nicomedes was
– Nicomedes, there we go.
Yeah, that was quite prevalent throughout his life. Cicero mentioned it. It was, you know, historians see it perhaps as a form of slander to ruin his reputation. It was a common form of slander at the time. But interestingly, Mark Antony also, afterwards during the Civil War, claimed that Octavian, aka Augustus, earned his adoption by Caesar through sexual favors. Suetonius later on said that that accusation was political slander. But so we know that it was, you know, saying, oh, well, he's gay or he had gay relationships, homosexual relationships, was a, you know, a fairly common form. It was the equivalent of saying that he was born in Kenya. Let's just say that.
Right. No, it was a very common tool. But for whatever reason, and he was a really young man when this supposedly happened. And so that was a very long time to be with him, and it bothered him. He was worried about his dignitas, and so he had to live with it just like everyone else did.
Yeah. What about the epilepsy? Do you think people know about Caesar and the epilepsy? I mean, certainly if you've read Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, it gets brought up in there. Caesar seemed to have suffered from some sort of malady. I believe that, you know, modern scholarship is kind of divided on the subject. Some scholars think that he may have had malaria, recurring bouts of malaria that he picked up on campaign. Some people believe that he had epilepsy. Certainly, I think in Shakespeare's account, it was claimed to be epilepsy, not that Shakespeare was much of an historian, obviously. And you would think perhaps that suffering from something severe like that could have played against him in terms of his success as a political leader or a military leader. But do you think it had any impact?
I'm not sure about that. I know he had to be careful. He had to make sure he got enough rest. And I think I've read somewhere that it affected him more as he got older. One of his first big attacks when he was on the run from Sulla, and he was hiding out with his big German slave, Burgundus, that Burgundus had to pretty much hold him down and make sure he didn't, you know, bite off his own tongue or just something to choke on his own tongue, because when it happened, it was pretty intense. But the Egyptians believed that it was just a part of his greatness, that it was just a sign showing that he was, you know, touched by the gods or whatever. But he certainly had to live with it, and he had to certainly be careful with it. And those who served him or who were around him had to be told of the secret so they could take care of him in case an attack came on. But I don't think it really affected him, or I don't think it really affected his career from what I've been able to read.
Another thing that I think people associate with Caesar is a Caesarian, the Caesarian section. And, you know, I've met a lot of people over the years who think that it's so called because Julius Caesar was born via a C-section. But there's no evidence for that.
Right, is there? Yeah, there's nothing like that. I mean, again, it just shows you the how much of an imprint he made on the Roman world at the time that they would name this after him. But we don't even have proof that he was actually born that way. But again, it just shows just how famous and how famous this man was that they would even think about naming that after him. Well, I'm sure there were tons of Caesarians before him.
You know? Yeah, I think it actually comes from the name of the law at the time. So the Roman ruling law, the imperial law, was Lex Caesarea. And part of that law was that if a mother died in childbirth, which obviously was very, very common in the ancient world, before the baby had been delivered, then the baby had to be cut from the womb. So, and this goes way back, I think, well before Caesar. So it was called the Lex Regia, the ruling law, and then later the Lex Caesarea. And so I think that where the term came from was that it was the law, you know, it was Caesarian law that the baby was cut from the womb, and over time it just became known as the caesarean section, caesarean.
Right.
But yeah, nothing to do with Julius
Caesar. Ah, I gotcha. Yeah, yeah, but yeah, it just got mixed up because of the words were so similar.
Yeah, which brings us to the term Caesar. Now, obviously, and I'm not sure how many people know this, but well, they know that the emperors from Octavian / Augustus onwards were called the Caesar. But what they may not know mm-hmm. is that there are words used for kings and emperors from all around the world that are bastardizations, if you like, or right. adoptions yeah. of the word Caesar. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, in fact, that it became a title after the time of Augustus. So Caesar, before he dies, he adopts Augustus, who's going to become Augustus, and so he takes on the name Caesar as well. And so, because Augustus reigned for so long, even though he wasn't technically king, he was the first among equals, but behind the scenes, Augustus really ruled Rome, and he ruled for so long, the Caesar part of it became a title, and so those who come after him took that, and it wasn't a name, it was a title. And like you said, it went on to the Kaiser in Germany with mm-hmm. another kind of spelling, and with the Tsar in Russia, again, a Russian version of that. So again, it's just the influence that Rome, it shows the influence that Rome had on the world at the time, which is absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I didn't realize that until, you know, when I was an adult. I never realized the connection between Kaiser and Tsar.
Me neither. Yeah, it's totally. Yeah, just again that influence that Rome had for being around for so many hundreds of years. It can't help but make an impression on the rest of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. So what else? The civic.
Oh, crown.
Sorry, do you want to say something?
No, I was just going to say, did we really cover, I don't know if we really covered very well, the Etu Brute.
Oh, Etu Brute,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I that's a good point. I mean, I think that's something that, again, people, if they know anything about Caesar and they've read Shakespeare, they think that his last words were Etu Brute. But, that's... Again, was Shakespeare's telling of events, which we're familiar with, but it kind of predates Shakespeare substantially. So Shakespeare was using that phrase that he probably borrowed from an earlier play called Caesar Interfectus from 1582 or The True Tragedy of Richard, Duke of York, where that phrase "Etu" had already been in use, but according to Roman historian Suetonius, who we've already mentioned several times, he claimed that Caesar's last words were the Greek phrase "Kaisu technon," which might mean "You too, child," or "You too, young man," or "You too, my child." And some people have suggested that it may have been an indication that Brutus was actually Caesar's illegitimate son.
Right.
Which, again, if that were to be true, adds a whole new flavor to, you know, Caesar's story and the role of Brutus in the assassination. Of course, for that to have been true, Caesar would have had to have impregnated Servilia Caeponius, Brutus's mother, when he was only 14 years and 2 months of age, based on their relevant ages, but not necessarily impossible.
Right. Yeah. Well, he is Caesar, so it's possible. No, but no, I think yeah. I mean, is it possible?
Don't have to be Caesar. I mean, I lost my virginity at 14, I think. So, you know, maybe somewhere out there one day I will have a son that will stab me to death that I don't know of yet.
Well, if your wife hears this, she might be the one stabbing you. But anyway, it might just mean more of an expression like, oh, and you too, my child, that kind of stuff.
My wife is 9 years younger than me. When I was 14, she was 5. So it wasn't with her. Anyway.
No, I didn't mean to imply that.
Oh, okay.
No.
That's good.
No, yeah, no. I think just the that expression is just more. He was just saying, "And you, young one," you know, that kind of stuff. Especially since he stabbed him in the groin, which again we don't know if that was on purpose or that just happened to be where the blade landed. So again, it was just one of those many things we'll never know.
Well, the other interpretation of it, and again, with anything that goes back to ancient history that's not very well documented, as most things from that era aren't, is that there's going to be some debate over, you know, what was actually said or what was meant by what was said. One of the other interpretations that I've read about the final words is that it might have been part of a longer phrase, which mm-hmm. was, "You too, my son, will have a taste of power," which might have kind of meant your turn next, Brutus, or to hell with you, Brutus.
Right.
So because it may be saying, okay, well, you know, you're going to get a taste of your own medicine kind of thing. Of course, you know, Brutus did meet his own violent death not too long later. But yeah, it's one of those mm-hmm. wonderful things about the story that we'll never really know exactly what he said or what he meant by what he said. But either way, it's beautifully poetic. Et tu, Brute. And I mean, when yeah. I was reading it with my kids, I was like, you know, just imagine this. Like he thinks of this guy as his friend, as his young son, as right. almost a son. You know, he's certainly somebody he's helped his career. You know, they've had their problems, but they've sorted it out. You know, he loves this man. And right. you know, Shakespeare makes a big deal out of the fact that Brutus loves Caesar and Caesar loves Brutus. And, you know, they're very, very close. And yet, mm-hmm. for whatever reason, Brutus
right.
you know, joins in the assassination. It's an incredibly tragic betrayal.
Right. And that's just what makes it so much more poignant. And again, it just draws people in to think that it could be, you know, the son could be killing the father, or at the very least the a person who was like a father to him, you know, killing that person.
Yeah, which of course, you know, brings up all sorts of Greek mythology and Freudian mm-hmm. issues. So let's move on then to the civic crown or the laurel wreath. Again, you see pictures of Caesar, or I think even if you just see a depiction of a laurel wreath, people probably associate it with, if anyone, Caesar.
Right.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the laurel wreath and the civic crown?
Well, now I've heard, I've read several different things, so maybe you can shed some light on this for me. There's the civic crown, and then there's the grass crown.
Yep.
Supposedly he won the civic crown, which I read was the second highest award that someone can get. And the grass crown, you know, if you were general in the field and you saved someone, you could be the, you know, if you did something personal which led your army to victory, then you should get the grass crown. But Caesar saved a person's life near the time when he was in Mithridatia with Bithynia. Sorry about that. So there was a battle and he saved someone's life and he won the civic crown, which was the second highest award. And because of Sulla's laws, that was taken very seriously. These things were not given out lightly. I mean, so some part of bravery on Caesar's part had to be true, and he had to wear it in public occasions, and people had to stand when he walked in and applaud him. So it was a very momentous thing to win at such a young age, but which already shows his athleticism and his courage and ability to fight in a battle.
Yeah, and so the civic crown was made of typically oak leaves, and it mm-hmm. was like made
which, yep.
to look like a crown, but it was the crown of the people, and it was given to a citizen, a military decoration, as you said, the second highest, given to a citizen for an act that saved lives. And according to Pliny, when he wrote about it, he said, and I'll read this in full because it's good stuff. "Nor is the same honor any greater mm-hmm. if the rescued person is a general, because the founders of this institution wished the honor to be supreme in the case of any citizen." So it didn't matter who you saved, you still receive the same honor and it still carried as much weight. The receiver of the wreath may wear it for the rest of his life. When he appears at the games, it is the custom for even the Senate always to rise at his entrance. And he has the right to sit next to the senators. And he himself and his father and his paternal grandfather are exempt from all public duties. Sitius Dentatus, as we have mentioned at the proper place, won 14 civic wreaths, and Capitolinus 6, one in his case being actually for saving the life of his commanding officer, Servilius. Scipio Africanus refused to accept a wreath for rescuing his father at the Trebia. How worthy of eternity is a national character that rewarded exploits so distinguished with honour only, and whereas it enhanced the value of its other wreaths with gold, refused to allow the rescue of a citizen to be a thing of price, thus loudly proclaiming that it is wrong even to save the life of a human being for the sake of gain. So you didn't get gold, you didn't get, you know, a reward for saving the life. You got to wear a crown of oak and you got honored for that. You didn't get monetary gain, you just got recognition. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other part of that is that the person that you saved had to be the one witness who says, yes, this person did save me. Even if I saw you save someone else, I couldn't. My word doesn't matter. The person that you saved has to be the person that says, yes, this person did save my life in this act. And so that was their way of making sure that it was something real and not made up. But yeah, there was no money involved. It was all about respect and again, just enhancing your career. So when you did go for office, you would have that. And that was a huge thing with the Roman people. They respected bravery and that kind of thing. And it made a huge difference because Caesar got that at a pretty young age. And it just was one of those things that helped launch his career.
Indeed. And we'll go into detail, obviously, about that story probably later on in the series. And I just wanted to point out that the whole idea of the laurel wreath that the civic crown was an example of, it goes back to ancient Greece. It wasn't necessarily a Roman thing. It was one of many ideas that they adopted from the Greeks. But, of course, you know, in modern times, we still have this idea or this phrase of somebody's resting on their laurels. Goes back to, well, in some ways, ancient Rome, and we just mentioned sort of, you know, some of the benefits that came with being awarded something like the civic crown. You could in some ways rest on that. It was also a way of denoting back in ancient Greece that somebody had a master's degree and you know they could rest on you know that accomplishment. And also in ancient Rome it was used to denote a number of different accomplishments that people could then you know rest on for the rest of their career. Of course, these days we still have poet laureates, we have Nobel laureates, and these are all traditions that go back to Rome, but also, of course, ancient Greece before that.
Right. And, of course, it's funny how people who will never get the Nobel Peace Prize or anything like that, you know, when you're at work and you're just an average Joe and someone says, what are you doing resting on your laurels? It has a slight negative connotation at that moment, but for everyone else, it's it means you've done something amazing and now you can just kick back because you've earned your stripes.
Exactly. Well, what else? Let's I guess finish up then. We're nearly at an hour. Mm-hmm. Let's finish up just talking a little bit about, you know, what are your thoughts on whether or not Caesar really did want to rule the world, or was he just trying to bring stability? What are your final thoughts on that?
Yeah, when Mark Antony offers him a crown and he turns it down, you know, was that staged? Was it sincere? Was Mark Antony trying to make Caesar look bad? And again, we'll never know the answer. But I think at the end of the day, he was probably going to take a page out of Sulla's book. He wanted to be dictator. He wanted to not have to worry about being persecuted after he was all done. I think he was going to set Rome back up on its feet, go invade Parthia. That was his big plan. I really think that he was going to do what he needed to do, fix Rome, and then go on with his career and just keep trying to be the first man in Rome, the first among equals, and just add on to his dignitas, because that was what he was obsessed about. I think he was just going to do his thing and keep going on until he died, and then just go down in history books like he has done as just one of the Rome's great, great leaders.
Yeah, I'm not as sure as about that as you are. I mean, which is good, because it means we won't just agree on everything for the rest of the show.
Yeah,
I mean, I try and put myself in Caesar's shoes. He's been made first dictator for 10 years in 46, and then in 44 he was made dictator for life. You know, some of the stuff that we have from Suetonius and Cicero seems to indicate that he was really making a lot of decisions about who got to stay, who got to go, that really had nothing to do with the stability of Rome. He was enjoying power a little bit too much, I think. I would like to think that he would have sorted stuff out and then resigned his dictatorship and gone off and fought more battles, but I'm not so sure about that. So We'll be able to debate that and discuss it later on. Hey, one thing I do want to point out, and this is probably going to upset a lot of particularly American listeners. You should get used to this, Ray. I tend to upset people all the time, particularly when I bring up religion.
There you go.
But one of the things that I've heard from Christian friends over the decades, when we get into a discussion about whether or not Jesus was an historical figure or not, is people say to me, there is more evidence for the historicity of Jesus than anyone else in ancient history. And then they always bring up Julius Caesar as an example.
Right.
How do we know Julius Caesar really existed?
Wow. I guess from, well, I mean, Cicero mentions him a lot in his letters.
So we have contemporaries.
We have contemporaries. Are there coins that have been struck of him when he was with Cleopatra?
Yes, we have coins.
There's a temple of Caesar that I visited on my honeymoon in Rome.
We have eyewitness accounts, people such as Cicero that you said, and contemporaries who wrote about him. But of course, he wrote himself. He wrote the history of his war with the Gauls. So he actually wrote stuff down, plus people who knew him firsthand wrote about him, plus, as you said, coins and all that kind of stuff from his time. So we actually, whilst, as you've said earlier in the show, a lot of the contemporary information about Caesar has been lost to antiquity. We don't have, unfortunately, the Library of Alexandria and places like that, which got torched.
Sorry.
You did it. You're responsible, are you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's just sad that that happened when Caesar was fighting off forces. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's only one of the times it got destroyed. You know, great tragedies. But, we do have quite a lot of evidence for Caesar's life, the fact that he existed. On the other hand, no contemporary accounts of Jesus. No, he didn't write anything down. No eyewitness accounts. So there's a big difference between Jesus, who, you know, supposedly lived 50, 60 years after Caesar's assassination. I guess my point only being that we've got a lot of stuff to help us in our journey of Caesar's life. Do you think we just lost the entire American audience?
I guess we'll find out. But the good news is that maybe I don't know. I certainly wasn't expecting that. But the story that we're going to get into is just an amazing story. There's amazing highs and lows, and there's tragedy, and there's victory, and there's a whole bunch of other amazing personalities that come into Caesar's story, and it is a roller coaster of a ride. And something like this, I mean, from what we do know, even though we don't know a lot about Caesar, you know, a lot of things that we wish we could. Just what we know is going to be enough to keep everybody coming back, because it's an amazing story and it was amazing times and it affected this part of the world. And I just can't wait to get into it.
Wow, nice concluding words. I'm not going to say anything and, you know, screw it up now. Good work. Yeah,
it's a hell of a ride. Caesar's life was a hell of a ride.
Lovely. That's the tagline. That's this gun on the poster, the movie poster. Caesar, it's a hell of a ride.
I've got nothing.
All right.